You've just heard Dawn from an album The Ornette Coleman Trio at the Golden Circle in Stockholm. We heard Ornette Coleman on alto saxophone, Charles Moffat on drums, and David Eisenson on bass. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to speak on the telephone with David Eisenson. First, a few words about him. In the 1960s, he recorded two albums with Ornette Coleman, a 1962 town hall concert recorded on ESP, and in 65, a Blue Note record, which we just heard an excerpt of. In 1968, Eisenson recorded a session for Prestige Records with pianist Jackie Byard and drummer Elvin Jones. The album, released under Byard's name, is called Sunshine of My Soul. In 1977, as a member of the Paul Modian Trio, he recorded an album called Dance. He also had a group of his own which didn't record, which is called the David Eisenson Quintet, whose members included drummer Barry Altschul, vibraphonist Carl Berger, and saxophonist Gatto Barbieri. In 68, he won the Downbeat Bass Player of the Year award, but it was also about that time that he decided to get a doctorate in human relations and psychotherapy. He had a private practice and gave that up for a while and became the director of the Lillian Wald Senior Citizens Center in New York. He now has a private practice. And then there's also a group that he started called Pot Smokers Anonymous, a group for people who smoke lots of dope and feel that it's interfering with their functioning, but they nevertheless are having trouble stopping. So we're going to spend the next few minutes on the phone with David Eisenson talking about his career in music and in psychotherapy. Well, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by going back to the 60s and in the days that you were playing with Ornette Coleman. How did you first meet up with him and become a member of that trio?
I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, you see, and I graduated from Carnegie Institute there with the bachelor's. And I got a scholarship to the Manhattan School of Music where I did my master's. My minor was psychology in my bachelor's studies. Now, I came here to Manhattan and I was studying and found myself in need of some money. At this point, I really looked around and said, who do I want to play with? And Ornette and Coltrane were the two people. Ornette was first and Coltrane was second, with all due respect to Coltrane. I thought I really could play with him. Can you hold? No, you can't. All right, so
is this something you have to do, David?
Yeah. No, it's too late.
Okay.
So, I called up Ornette, and at that time, Jimmy Garrison was playing bass with him. And they were playing at the Five Spot and asked him if I can come down and to sit in and audition with him. It just happened that Jimmy was going to join Coltrane's group, so he was looking for a new bass player to join his group. And I sat in with his group. Then about 2 months passed, and Ornette called me up and asked me if I would like to join his group. They were going to open up at another club, and we started to rehearse together. And I would say that it was love at first sight for both of us. And we stayed together until 68, around 68, although I did perform with him last year at the Newport Jazz Festival. And in 74, I did go to Chicago with him for a couple of weeks. Charlie Hayden was back with him, and then Charlie became ill and couldn't join him, so I substituted for him.
Ornette Coleman, when he started playing, wasn't exactly the darling of the critics. His work was met with a lot of confusion and mixed reactions. I take it that, you know, you were really interested and excited by his playing. What kind of reaction did your bass playing get when you first became, you know, affiliated with him and started playing with him?
I think I was kind of fortunate that it got a positive reaction. It fitted in really well with Ornette. I mean, we played well, really well together. There were some of the professionals who were a little uptight about it. But generally speaking, I didn't get I felt I was treated with respect. What more can you ask?
The avant-garde of the 60s was a frequently political group of musicians and a largely black group of musicians. Was it kind of unusual for you to be a white person with an otherwise black trio who was playing pretty avant-garde music?
Well, that's an interesting question. Ornette had been approached by several black bass players on the basis of a racist attitude on their part, and his response, much to his credit, was, "Look, I don't care if you're blue or pink or red. It's the music that I'm interested in." And there would be times when we would actually joke about it so as to defuse the issue, because race is not the real issue. Music is the real issue. And we would diffuse it by saying, "Well, Isaacson's really black, passing as white."
Mm-hmm.
Everyone would laugh about it, and that would be the end of that. He made it clear, and we all made it clear, that we were together not only because we enjoyed being with each other as human beings, but that we really had this mutual meeting ground, calling love of playing music together, and that we were enhancing each other's relationship in that way.
In 1968, Downbeat named you the Jazz Bass Player of the Year, and then you shortly thereafter went to work on your doctorate in human relations and psychotherapy. I'm interested in why, when your music was being very well recognized and you were doing fantastic playing, you decided to get a doctorate in psychotherapy.
Well, at that time, Ornette, the trio broke up, which I was sorry to see. And with it, the spell of that whole thing, of that whole period, broke up. And once the spell broke up, we all started to think of different things, wanting to do something else. Although, while we were getting a tremendous amount of recognition, and we're having a lot of pleasure and fun and satisfaction, there still in our souls, one might say, the desire to be more creative, desire to be challenging ourselves, and the status quo having changed by the fact that we broke up. Blackwell joined the group. Charlie Hayden joined the group. We were playing with two basses. We traveled with that unit. I think that was it. Ornette was expanding his own instrumental repertoire to the violin, and had expanded it, I should say, but and the trumpet. And then DiNardo, his son, was coming around to start playing, and I felt that there was something missing in my life. There was some element that I couldn't quite place my finger on at that time, and actually entered into therapy myself to find out what it was, because ostensibly, as you put it, I had everything that I wanted. By the way, when we recorded those beautiful records, I'm just saying I enjoyed them, in 65, I was on my honeymoon, and I was very much in love. I still am, I'm happy to say. But there was still something missing, you see. So I felt that science had some of the answers for it, rather than the gurus. I was kind of an anti-guru or anti-authoritarian person. I think that's part of the psychological personality of the avant-garde, people who want to discover new things for themselves and not take the traditional way. Sometimes we think of traditions as being nothing more than bad habits. So I went into therapy, and it was there that I discovered that I had a facility, a sensitivity to people, and was encouraged to go to school. With that in mind, I decided that that's what I wanted to do. Quite frankly, my wife wasn't too happy about it. She said, never forget this, she said, "The world needs more musicians and less therapists." Well, I promised her that I was really going not so much to be a therapist as much as I was to find out what was going on for myself and what was missing. Actually, what was missing was that I really wasn't as in contact with myself as I thought I was.
Well, during this period, did your music become more of something that existed only, like, for your pleasure and for your just kind of, you know, experimentation or whatever, as opposed to something that you really had to do to make money and perhaps, you know, accepting dates you didn't want to accept or whatever?
Yeah, that's true, too. But, you know, what was really, as that question you brought to my mind, what was really bothering me was the question, why couldn't we celebrate in life, everyday life, what those feelings, those beautiful feelings we celebrate in that meeting hall that we call music. Why was it when I stopped playing music and I was no longer involved in the creative process that I felt empty? Why, like now, I don't feel empty as I'm speaking to you, but it seemed to me in those days that I only celebrated life when I was playing music, and I wanted to celebrate life 24 hours a day. 7 days a week. And that was the question that I think that motivated me to go into finding out what was happening with psychotherapy. You know, at one point I started to think that psychotherapy is superstition as much as a science, until I started to find out that there are some good things about it and there are some negative things about it.
You know, it's interesting. You said that you were more into science than into gurus. It's interesting now to see how many jazz musicians who were once associated with the avant-garde are into, for instance, Scientology or some new and leading guru. Do you have any thoughts about why
that
phenomenon is taking
place? I think that underneath these belief system is a nervous system, and that's exactly where it's at. I feel that that they pay a price for that kind of belief system. And it ultimately makes, they use it as a crutch, and it ultimately is a ripoff somewhere along the way. Without getting into a big thing about it, I think that I'll let it go at this point.
Okay, you mentioned the word crutch, and that leads me to one of the activities that you're involved with now, which is a group you started called Pot Smokers Anonymous, in which you are the leader and director and try to help people who are trying to stop smoking dope but are having difficulties doing so. It's kind of mysterious to me that, you know, a jazz musician, someone associated with the avant-garde of jazz particularly, would be involved with that when, after all, I mean, marijuana has really been a very accepted part of the jazz scene for decades. And, you know, it's just unusual to find a jazz musician arguing against the use of marijuana or trying to help people stop smoking dope. How did you get to that?
Well, you know, I think that if musicians didn't use any substances, now it's not only just marijuana. There's a lot of cross addiction in terms of alcohol, tobacco, and even hard drugs like heroin. I think that if the musicians did not use these substances and were really in touch with themselves, I mean really in touch with themselves, the music all these years would have been a much higher quality, and the people to whom the music are being communicated to would have gotten much better vibes than they have gotten. I think it's rather ironic that people, and this is one of the most popular excuses or reasons that I hear at Pot Smokers Anonymous, is that I listen to music to enhance my listening to music. And my response to it is that the price for enhancement is your mind. That's too big of a price to pay. And in some way, I hold the musicians responsible because I think that the vibes that they set off come back and they create more vibes. And I think that if the musicians are really together, of course, don't forget, musicians are human beings playing music. And I give them a tremendous amount of credit, on the other hand, because they've risen above the problems of this racist society, of this escapist society, to find the energy, the initiative, and the time to do what they've done. So I know that as a player that we use drugs to feel normal, you might say. We used it, but that was because we didn't have something else to use instead, which was what Pot Smokers Anonymous teaches, and that is your emotional recognition course. What else you have is your real self. Now when I play, I expect to play more beautifully than I ever played. I'm not coming on to say beautiful like I play beautifully. I mean that I've developed, I think my own playing has developed better. And I've seen it happen in other musicians who have completed the course who have given me the feedback that their playing is more real. When they play with energy and urgency and with a strong feeling, it has more meaning rather than some of the frantic music that came out of the 60s. And the musicians, rather than recognizing their own responsibility in terms of not getting public response, and I'm not talking about several hundred, there's always several hundred people who will like anything that anyone does. I'm talking about getting a following that music requires to be sustained in terms of being a valid way of living. They blame society, or they blame the music business, rather than taking the responsibility for what is going on and saying, look, if people are not responding to my music, I better check out my music.
You associate lots of marijuana with the really out there avant-garde music of the 60s, but in the 1930s, you know, songs like If You're a Viper and Texas Tea Party and Sweet Marijuana Brown and Reefer Man were being recorded, which were really, you know, 1930s up-tempo dancing tunes and weren't, you know, really out there avant-garde things and were equally, you know, recorded also by people who obviously smoked.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was 6 years old when marijuana was made illegal. And it was really ironic, even during the time that it was legal, people from Mexico were smuggling the dope in. I never could figure out why they were doing it if it was legal. And it was prescribed by doctors. It was used. Extracts were used. You could buy them. Our grandmothers could really get high legally, and it developed a very negative attitude. And I think that the fact that people were I don't forget, in the 30s also came about when jazz was at one time our national music and the most respected music, came around the downfall of it. I mean, the whole thing swung around to the negative side because of that, which I think is very unfortunate.
Have you played any dates where you felt that, you know, like smoking dope really, either in yourself or in any other musicians who were playing at that time, really had a bad effect on the session? You know, that the music really would have been better?
Well, and was... The only way that you know that it's had a bad effect is when you... Excuse me.
We're talking, by the way, with David Eisenson.
You know, the only way that you have a bad effect on it is when you stop doing it to know what you're really feeling and what's really going on,
mm-hmm.
so that you can compare yourself. Yeah, some musicians have reported paranoia. I remember one musician saying he thought that someone was trying to kill him. I mean, that is the most, admittedly, that is the most severe effect. But I have gotten angry at musicians saying, hey, you're not doing your best. Something is holding you back. You have a low energy level that's happening. I've seen that happen. I've also heard musicians play lousy in the sense that they repeat the ideas, or the ideas are repetitious, or the music goes to a certain spot and stays there. It doesn't flow along. It doesn't move. I think that it becomes uninteresting after a while. Like you hear four ideas or one idea, or you hear one idea expressed for half an hour. I mean, the musician isn't even aware that he or she, what they're playing.
It's really difficult sometimes, though, isn't it, to associate what's the cause of just mediocrity and repetitious ideas and what's, you know, when the repetition is caused not by the musician's own creative restrictions, but rather by the smoking of dope.
Well, you know, there are people who report a cognitive disability, meaning they really simply forget what the hell they're doing. Something as severe as calling up someone and saying, oh, God, who is this? You know? I mean, that happens frequently to people who are smoking a lot of dope, or walking from one room to another and forgetting what it is that he or she has gone to the other room for. And in playing music, they frequently forget, you know, what, especially free music. Free music is the most difficult music in the world to play because you have, at that point, said, I am free of the restrictions that, say, bebop has. You know, one definition of free jazz that I heard was that it's music that you get in without paying a fee for. But really, it really means that you've taken on a responsibility as a composer to create music and to make it flow and to relate to the theme and to use that as a point of departure. And when you play one solo on one tune and you have another tune to play and then you start listening and, hey, there's no harmonic difference, there's no rhythmic difference, there's no emotional difference. And I think marijuana is one of the victims, rather one of the villains of this, because it's a fat soluble, it's stored in the brain. And when I listen to my own playing during the times, and that was one of the reasons that I stopped recording, because I knew that it wasn't happening for me. But I was really cheating the fans. I have a responsibility that as a professional and creative artist to keep. And that the memory is gone, and it's not there to help you in your own way. You know, we get frustrated in life, and many people smoke to avoid the frustration that there is. And the frustration is a very positive quality if you can use it. It gives you a tremendous amount of energy. You can use it to practice if that's what you want to do. It uses you to get to a better place.
Would you be against the decriminalization of marijuana?
At this point, I have two answers to that question. As a graduate of Pot Smokers Anonymous, no one really cares about it anymore. I want to say, you mean it isn't? It isn't legal. It's so available at this point. We don't care about alcohol. We don't care about tobacco. We don't care about any substances at all because we have developed this emotional recognition skill and really are in touch with ourselves. It's like, do you ever have a day where everything really went right, or just about everything, and you felt fantastic, and you went home feeling really high and good about yourself, and then you put on a television set and it looks flat because it's really flat. It doesn't have any real dimension, and you turn it off because it's unsatisfying.
Yeah, sure.
That's the kind of feeling that people can get on a daily basis, not just when something goes right for them, but because they feel good about themselves. The second answer is that what I would really like to see is that it gets decommercialized. By that I mean, if anybody wants to smoke pot, they could learn how to grow in their pots at home and their windowsills and their grow lights at home, as many people are doing. They can grow to the potency and the quantity they like in a very short period of time and take the decommercialization out of it completely. That's what I would prefer.
So you don't really want to see people risking prison for smoking it, but you hope that they...
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me just ask you, most of the clients who you work with in your private practice, are they aware of your work as a musician?
No, they're not. I mean, they're coming to me in my capacity as a therapist and are not familiar at all with... I'm trying to think in my head. As a matter of fact, during the past 10 years, I think this is the actual first phone call where I feel that I'm speaking to someone who knows me in terms of my musical background and my work as a therapist.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's really amazing, but it's just like I've had two lives.
That's interesting because, you know, in your description of it, it sounds like one, you know, that both your reasons for playing music and your reasons for being in psychotherapy are really very well connected in your mind, although the people you work with in both ends of it may not have those connections themselves. We're going to, before we go to another record, which I want to ask you about, I did I just want to ask you if your work with Pot Smokers Anonymous is making any musicians who do smoke dope a little uncomfortable about you as, you know, as a fellow musician giving dope smokers a bad name.
I haven't heard of any.
Good.
No, not really, but I would imagine that if it did. I have met a couple musicians that were very uncomfortable and very uptight about it, but then I look at musicians as people who play music. I've taken them off the pedestal. And if I see someone who's uptight, no matter what, and I've met people who are uptight about it, then I think that they have a problem, regardless of what they do for a living or what identity they have. I think people have got to stop hiding behind labels. Prior to, as you mentioned in your introduction of me, I worked as a director of in a geriatric unit with old people. And I have dealt with many people who lived their life under the label that they had. They were a physician or attorney. Now that they're no longer functioning, they don't exist. And I think that's erroneous. That we're really human beings who have these various functions. Like at some point I'm a father, at some point I'm a lover, at some point I'm a musician, at some point I'm a therapist. But basically, I'm a human who does these things. So when I meet a musician, like I did meet two, as a matter of fact, yesterday, and they were making what I thought were bad jokes about the whole thing until I asked them to check themselves out, and then that settled the whole thing.
Interesting points. Listen, we're about out of time. I'd love to keep talking. I hope sometime you could join us live in the studios in Philadelphia. We're about to hear another one of your recordings from an album called Sunshine of My Soul, in which you're featured along with Jackie Byard at the piano and Elvin Jones on drums. We'll be hearing the St. Louis Blues from that album. Can you just say a few words about that session before we hear it?
Well, that's my nonverbal. I'm laughing because it was a fun session. Jackie and Elvin are absolutely, what can I tell you, top, really creative musicians. I used to play in a trio with a drummer by the name of Stu Martin and a piano player by the name of Joe Ciani. We did I did a duo record called Man Running with the piano player. And we worked opposite Mingus's band, and Jackie was in the band every night. He and Eric Dolphy and Mingus, and I forgot the trumpet player's name, I'm sorry, Cole, his name was. And we listened to them every night, and so when I walked in the studio, I knew I was playing with a piano player who was extremely sensitive to bass players. And, of course, Elvin's playing. I played with Coltrane. I sat in one night in the old Half Note with him, and I had always heard his playing, but there's really no comparison to hearing someone play and playing with him. That's when I really recognized the genius of this man. And we went in there and really had a fantastic time. I think that the producer of that was Don Schlitten, the man there. And I was really one of the high experiences in my life. And I don't mean that drug-wise.
Okay. Well, it's a great album. We'll be hearing some of that now. David Eisenson, thanks so much for spending some time with us on the telephone today. And hope we could speak with you again sometime on Fresh
Air.
That's
very kind of you, Tara. Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Great. Well, have a real nice day, and thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now. Bye. I've been speaking on the telephone with David Eisenson, who spoke to us from New York. He's a bass player who has spent about 5 or 6 years with the Ornette Coleman Trio, recorded 2 albums with him, recorded with Jackie Byard, and recorded most recently with the Paul Modian Trio. He also had a group of his own, which included Carl Berger and Agato Barbieri, Barry Altschul. But they, although David Eisenson has his own recordings of the group never recorded on a record. Well, from the 1968 session with Jackie Byard that he was just speaking to us about, we're going to hear a recording of St. Louis Blues. Again, it's Jackie Byard at the piano, Elvin Jones drums, and David Eisenson bass. Thank you. On that 1968 recording of St. Louis Blues, we heard from Jackie Byard at the piano, Elvin Jones drums, David Eisenson bass, featured on an album called Sunshine of My Soul, the Jackie Byard Trio. We hope that David Eisenson can join us live in the studios later in the year on Fresh Air. When he spoke to us earlier, he spoke to us on the telephone from New York. Well, this is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and it's 7 minutes to 3 o'clock. Every Thursday on Fresh Air, we feature Interval, which is produced and hosted for Fresh Air by Francis Davis. Thursdays on Interval, Francis features out-of-print jazz recordings. Today he's going to feature out-of-print recordings that were composed and arranged by George Russell.
Francis Davis, and this is Interval, a segment of Fresh Air devoted to out-of-print jazz. In 1948, Miles Davis formed a nine-piece band with an unusual instrumentation. It included a French horn and a